from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Beautiful Gregorian chant, the liturgical music first popularized throughout the Universal Church in the 5th century, remains still popular in Catholic and even secular culture today. On Register Radio, we find out why chant has endured the test of time with music scholar and author Dr. James Jordan. But first, we turn to another timeless treasure of Catholicism, the Doctors of the Church, as we talk about an EWTN series produced by our very own Dr. Matthew Bunsen. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, and I'm joined, as usual, by Matthew Bunsen, the Register's senior editor and co-host for Register Radio. Matthew, you have produced a series for EWTN, and this series has long been a thought in your mind.
It has, yeah. So first, great to be with you, as always. Yeah, years ago, I fell in love with the Doctors of the Church, and EWTN has given me the great privilege of trying to put together a series like this. And so their confidence might be misplaced, but we've had a really good start to the series, and I have to say that it is a privilege professionally, but also very personally and spiritually, to be able to put together a series like this.
So describe a little bit about, I mean, these are Doctors of the Church, people who've lived over long periods of time. There really aren't a lot of photographs, things like that. So what, right. What do you do? How do you pull out the Doctors of the Church in this series?
Well, we have 36 Doctors of the Church, stretching all the way from St. Athanasius in the 4th century all the way to Thérèse of Lisieux, who died at the end of the 19th century. So you can imagine that those 36 extraordinary lives spanning literally the history of the Church. I mention that because trying then to put together a documentary on their lives that relies on experts as well as recreations, but especially art. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that long hours, long days, and even weeks are spent for each episode trying to come up with just the right art and beautiful renderings of the doctors in their times. And then that all has to be woven together. So it's one of the fun things about it is you really run across all the different media that touches on their lives, but also helps to explain them a little better to the average audience.
Absolutely. And the very first Doctor of the Church that you discuss and you share with your audience is St. Athanasius.
That's right. So as I was saying, he lived in the 4th century, the defender of orthodoxy. Some call him the Doctor of the Incarnation because of his defense of the divinity of Christ in the face of the Arian controversy. And one of the things that is very striking about his life is it's, as we point out in the episode, he was exiled 5 times by 4 different Roman emperors who were trying to impose their view of Arianism on the Church. And his exiles took him as far off as the snowy fields of Germany to the Rome in the summers. And then, of course, to the blistering deserts of Egypt. At one point, he had to hide among the tombs of family to avoid murder.
So the unstoppable Athanasius.
Yeah, he drove his enemies literally crazy with his ability to endure exiles and being hunted like a common criminal. And all while he did it, he was always writing. He never stopped writing to his flock in Alexandria and to the wider church, defending the divinity of Christ. And, of course, in the end, he won because the church won.
So, Matthew, we don't have much time left, but really, why are the Doctors of the Church relevant for us today?
Well, there are 3 things that you have to be or to receive to be a Doctor of the Church. The first is you have to be declared a saint. So right there we have a perfect role model for mm-hmm. what we're trying to do in our lives. So everyone is called to holiness, so the doctors are a great model for us. And then you have to leave behind eminent teachings. And even someone like Thérèse of Lisieux, who really just left behind an autobiography and some prayers and things, but she did it in such an extraordinary way that John Paul II made her a Doctor of the Church. So their writings, their teachings are important for us to study in our Catholic lives, but also to be well-rounded human beings. And then you have to have a declaration by the Church of a person is a doctor, usually by mm-hmm. a pope. And that tells us, too, that we rely on the church to hold them up as role models in our lives. And so when you read, like, the life of Athanasius, you come to the very quick conclusion that you have to follow his example in standing firm in the obedience to the church, but also in being able to teach the faith, to know the faith, and then to proclaim it boldly.
And, of course, doctors help you in sickness and in health. So the doctors of the church can help us in our spiritual health. And we certainly need to rely on them. You can find more information about EWTN's Doctor of the Church series by Dr. Matthew Bunsen on doctorsofthechurch.com. When we return from the break, we'll be joined by Dr. James Jordan and the sounds of Gregorian chant. Stay tuned.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Tim Staples.
The National Catholic Register gives you the world's news like no other. Only NCR has a stable of writers steeped in good Catholic theology and philosophy to give you the news with proper perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner or call 1-800-421-3230.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. And of course, I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. And we have a special guest today. Dr. James Jordan has performed as an organ accompanist, a soloist throughout the United States and Eastern and Western Europe. Dr. Jordan has also done extensive work in Gregorian chant, and that's why I wanted to have him on the show today. He has published in several outlets, American Choral Review, and is a contributing author to American Sacred Choral Music, an overview and handbook by Paraclete Press. And so recently, Paraclete Press sent me a wonderful set of CDs with Gregorian chant from the monastic choir of St. Peter's Abbey in Salem, France. And I loved the set, and I wanted to share it with our audience, but I don't actually know very much about chant. So Dr. Jordan, Jim, welcome to the show, because you're the one who is the expert on chant, and I'm so grateful to have you.
Well, it's great delight to actually be able to talk with you all.
So recently, I got this set of CDs, and I thought, okay, I don't know anything about chant, and the perfect thing is one of the CDs is called Rediscovering Chant, and the other is called Learning About Chant. And so I thought, okay, this is part of what Paraclete Press does. This is part of what you do. You want to help people rediscover Gregorian chant. And so I thought, what is chant? What are we talking about here, Jim?
Well, with chant, you're talking about it from a couple of different aspects. First and foremost, it's sung prayer.
Mm-hmm.
The reason, pardon me, that chant comes to life and has ever come to life is it's drawn literally out of the text. Its meaning is drawn from the text it supports. The melodies themselves are often simple, but sometimes complex, but they have such incredible beauty to them. But I wanted to make a point on that because we often do retreats for chant, and people's first thing they say oftentimes is, I don't know any Gregorian chant. And, I look at them and smile because oftentimes they just don't realize they know any. If you have something like, humbly I adore thee, verity unseen, or let all mortal flesh, there's all kinds of things that, and they look and they say, but I do know that.
Sure.
I said, right.
It's a part of our mass.
Your hymnal.
Right.
You do know then things that are chant. It's that we may not know it in some of its original context.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that instantly opens a door because chant, first having been a completely aural tradition, they're quite moved instantly that they already do know something.
Absolutely.
And that often opens the door then for the further discussion.
Yeah, Dr. Pope St. Gregory I the Great is traditionally credited with starting Gregorian chant, but what can you tell us about its origins, and why exactly has it endured for so long? Because it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, by trade, I am an organist, and I came into this because I'm a member of a Benedictine community, and it just sends chills down my spine to talk about it now. I've so fallen in love with it. I mean, when it comes to Pope Gregory the Great really was responsible for the codification. I mean, he did us the great favor of putting it together, and this is obviously a great sweeping generality, but in ways that it could be then used. But its endurance, for one thing, it takes us back to our earliest roots. Many of the early chants, say, for instance, the Lamentations of Jeremiah, which we hear in the Triduum during Holy Week, these relate very directly to chants that are heard still in the Jewish synagogue. So we're taken back even to our Jewish roots, which is one of the most marvelous things about it, because it's such a close link for all of us to the early church. I believe the endurance comes from what I was just talking about a moment ago. It's absolutely derived from the text. One particular example, if you think about something, for instance, Maundy Thursday, when we sing at the foot washing, Ubi caritas est vera Deus ibi est, you know, where God is, where true love is, God is truly there. One can say that text, Ubi caritas est vera, but if you actually chant it, Ubi caritas est vera, it lifts it out of the everyday mode. And that, I believe, is one of the reasons. Plus, if you listen to that, it's an extremely simple tune.
Right.
One that's easily memorable, just like children's songs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that chant has in common with pieces like even folk songs, because they're an early part of our childhood thinking.
Absolutely. It's so wonderful that you bring that up. I remember being at a mass recently where I was in a kind of, it was like almost a cry room, and I walked back from receiving communion, and there was an older child, I mean, not old enough to be in the cry room by himself while his parents went to communion, you know, six mm-hmm. or seven. Mm-hmm. And I, as I walked back in, he was humming a part of the mass. And of course, it's, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. It is memorable, even to a child.
We have a joke here. I have an 18-year-old and a 23-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And you should hear the kids chant.
I bet.
And I've told them, I've said, you know, you have something I will never have in my life. You will have grown up with this.
Beautiful, right.
And it's something that you should treasure, because even though I've learned it as an adult, I said, it will be part of your earliest memories.
Yes.
And the children take this up extremely quickly.
Well, I have actually used the set of CDs that I received from Paraclete Press, the ones from the Monks of Salem. I've used that in my house to pacify my very young children in the evenings when it's the sort of bewitching mm-hmm. hour of lots yeah. of tears and cries. And I put this on, and it has the effect of bringing peace to my household. And hopefully my kids can grow up with this as well. But I want to turn to the monks of the Abbey of Salem. They have a very special mission. Can you tell us about that mission?
Well, of course, their mission, you know, initially, Salem, of course, was really where monasticism itself had a rebirth in France. Part of that mission with Dom Guéranger, because of his personal love to begin with, before actually being given instruction by the church to do so, was this restoration of Gregorian chant. Now, what does that mean? There's actually a very funny line. We publish a book at Paraclete called Salem and Dom Guéranger, and there's a very funny quote from the abbot at that early on who said, chant has now devolved into the hammering of individual pitch and has nothing to do with the words.
Mm.
And they instantly, even in the late 19th century, worked on turning that around. And that is one of the things they're most known for now is, of course, that beauty in the way they do it. You hear the rhythm and the lilt of the chant with the text rhythm, because that is what drives the rhythm of chant. And, of course, they were given this job. The term restoration has many aspects to it. First and foremost, it's alive.
Mm-hmm.
It's being chanted in the offices. It's the divine office. It's part of, you know, St. Benedict in his rule talks about this and says, you know, nothing should be preferred over the Opus Dei, the work of God, which is the divine office. Along with that, though, they have done all these years of study of the earliest manuscripts, finding the ancient neumes, doing that kind of work, particularly Dom Eugène Cardin, in the middle of the 20th century. And the great thing about that is as he did those studies, what it does is it simply unlocks more of what the earliest composers of the chants saw inside the text.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, one of the greatest things they offer is that you hear this in these recordings. You mentioned the Gregorian chant rediscovered, which is actually from 1930.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And one point I want to make with them and those recordings, the underlying principle to why they did it was that they wanted to offer something to everybody because they knew not everybody could get to Salem.
Sure.
And that being said, every monk was in the choir.
Mm.
Because they wanted to make a point of saying this is not music just for the talented few. This is sung prayer that belongs to all of us.
It's wonderful. And I mean, it's wonderful to know that, too, because I think, as we said, it gets stuck in your head. So if you listen to this, you can sing along once you start to learn the rhythms of it. Of course, a lot of it is in Latin, and we don't all know the Latin, but it's so rhythmic that it really does stick with you. I did want to ask you, well, first of all, I guess I want to let people know where they can get these wonderful CDs, and they can be found at paracletepress.com, and I'll spell that, paracletepress.com. And, of course, if you look for the Monks of Salem, and that is spelled Solesmes, you will find it there at Paraclete Press. But if we had to start with one, Jim, which one would you suggest getting if you had to start with one of these CDs to learn about chant?
Well, I would actually begin with Vespers and Compline. And I will tell you why. That is actually, there's a reason that is their most popular recording in terms of sales and how often it goes out to people. Because it's the services. It's mm-hmm. the actual liturgy. And people are captivated by this because they are literally walking into a service with this CD. And particularly the office of Compline, in which the psalmody remains the same throughout the year, regardless of the season.
Right.
You may have a hymn tune change, you may have an antiphon change, but the psalms remain the same every night. That is something people can listen to on a regular basis and join in with it. And that, plus the simple fact that there is always something, that they've used the phrase that Compline is like putting the church to bed.
Right.
And, of course, it is obviously the prayers, the psalm prayers of protection for the church at night. But I would highly recommend beginning with that, because when you're first learning about chant, the first thing you don't want to do is read a book. The first thing you want to do is actually chant.
Right.
That is what will captivate you. That is what will pull you in to say, what is this? Why is this moving around inside of me like this, and how do I do more?
Right, absolutely, and it makes total sense. My first introduction to chant, as far as I can remember, was as a college student attending morning prayer. So it wasn't Vespers, but it was morning prayer. But it's the same idea, the same chants, and they're repetitive. And it totally drew me in. In fact, it drew me in so much that it made me consider religious life at that point in my time, because I was so drawn to that beauty. Which brings me, if you have time for another question.
By all means.
I would love to ask this question. So Pope St. Pius X used the term pray with the help of beauty. How does chant do that?
Well, it's interesting you put it that way. It relates a little bit back to what we talked about right at the beginning of our conversation. The beauty of chant resides not only in its melody. It resides, and you actually said this with the, you can hear the rhythm of the Latin. It resides in that.
Mm-hmm.
And as Dom Cardin said one time, every time you chant, it will be different because it is alive, because God's word is alive. And so your circumstances are always a little different. But when you walk into the church, think for yourself for a moment. When you walk in, you're coming into a space that has conceivably various kinds of art. It's not a space like any place else you are. You're already set apart. And then the beauty of that sound lifting the chant out the way that it does, I do actually believe that is what constitutes the beauty, and that's what causes people to return to it all the time. Because not only is it beautiful that way, but just to give you a couple of quick examples, if you, for instance, take the introit, the opening of the introit for Christmas Eve, which is Dominus dixit ad me, the Lord said unto my Lord, today I have begotten thee. But you have just that simple childlike interval, and it's quite quiet. And then on Easter morning, you have the introit resurrexi. Resurrexi, Jesus speaking to the Father, I'm arisen. Alleluia. In the cave.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that cause it to just jump for me personally, because it teaches by sound just as much as an art program in a church teaches by sight. It teaches by sound, because the big chants of those 2 days are they're the large ones, you know, Puernatus est, which of course is at Christmas morning. But the night before, we're still quite quiet. We're in with the animals. Jesus is just born. That, I believe, that's the drama that we find in the words put into the chant. And I think that's what constitutes the beauty, that people, even if they can't put words to it, I can't tell you how many times I have seen people go, oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
They've recognized it when somebody describes it.
To be simple, it just puts it lifts your soul. It's something you feel in your soul,
and it absolutely is.
Yeah, Matthew, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, there's an idea here that Pope Leo XIII wanted to restore and preserve the rich tradition of Gregorian chant with the monks of Solesmes. What was it that needed to be restored and preserved exactly? Because there's a sense with the birth of polyphony that something happened to Gregorian chant. Would that be an accurate statement?
Oh, extraordinarily accurate. Because without going into too many historical details, chant over a period of time, and certainly by the time we had come to the time of Palestrina, you know, the great early polyphonist, the Renaissance, chant had transformed, certainly in Italy and surrounding areas, into something that had become quite slow and heavy.
Mm.
And you can actually compare the earliest manuscripts with, you know, the larger choir books that one often sees under museum glass these days. And you see just huge square notes, what's called now Roman notation, over these, and of course we need those, or we wouldn't really know some of these tunes, well, really largely any of them. But what happened is, in a way, though chant is really the grandfather of Western music took over on chant.
Hmm.
and it became kind of more a musical vehicle and also a display for vocal talents. I mean, it's documented that people who sang at La Scala on Saturday night went in and sang at St. Peter's on Sunday. And so, you know, this is what was happening, to the point where by the mid-18th century, you can actually read documents where the chant is simply called corrupted. It's kind of a strong word, but that is the term that's used, because notes have been lost, it's been slowed down. You can see this as the manuscripts changed. What needed to be restored was, what were those original melodies? But moreover, how was it done? Now, of course, none of us were there. But as Dom Cardine did his work, this is what's so absolutely incredible about studying the ancient neumes, which are derived from really from linguistic signs, periods, question marks, so forth, various kinds of accents from other languages besides English. And he took manuscripts and he drew them by hand into a book, into his Roman gradual, with those chants. And when he completed it, he said, "I knew then what those symbols were. They were inflections from the choir master, showing how to lift this word, lengthen that word." And that is what needed to be restored, was chant's original life in illuminating the text.
And it seems that one of the other things that was restored, as I listened to this, the whole of this interview, is kind of the simplicity that allowed not just the very best musicians, the very best cantors to sing this, but as you said, the Salem monks made these CDs together, or the whole body of monks, because it's possible for everybody. So maybe there was this return back to the community can do this.
it's well known that there, you know, some chants are made for the congregants at large. Some are more complex.
Sure.
However, I will tell you, in our Benedictine house, everybody tries everything because we feel very strongly about this. And Mary Berry, the great chant scholar from Cambridge, England, herself was an Augustinian canoness, and her mother house was Solem. She had been a student of Cardine. We studied with her for many years. She used to close all of her retreats on chant. She said, "You will pass this along to everyone, won't you? Because it belongs to all of us."
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Jordan, for joining us today. For more information on chant, go to paracletepress.com. That's P-A-R-A-C-L-E-T-E press, P-R-E-S-S.com. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. And don't forget to click on the podcast that says Register Radio. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.